We're pleased to have Jacob Rosen here today from the University of Washington. He got his PhD from Tel Aviv in 1997, and there he worked on exoskeletons. And he's been at the University of Washington since 1997. He's working on medical robotics, and that's what he'll be telling us about today.
Thank you. So I'm going to tell you actually two stories today, and the centerpiece of both of them is the human, not necessarily me. And philosophically, if you think about that, we are the only species that actually study themselves. And that's what makes us unique and makes the problem that we are dealing with interesting and complicated at the same time. So the first story is about surgical robotics, and there are different layers to this story. I'll try to cover all of them. The second one is wearable robotics. These are robots that you can wear like your sleeve, but they have actuation capabilities, and I'll talk a little bit about how we interact with these things. So the big picture of medical procedure. Both surgery and procedure in general, you can do it either working on a real tissue over here or a simulated tissue. You can interact with the tissue through your tool or through a robot. In a simulation setup, you can interact with real representation of the tissue or through a haptic device on a virtual tissue. What is unique to all of these modalities is the fact that there is a human in the loop. And there is the same interface between the human, and regardless of which modalities you're dealing with, there is an information that is flowing back and forth. And understanding what is flowing here at this interface is key to understand and develop each of these systems. So I'll start with telling you a little bit about surgical robotics. Just to those of you who are not familiar, this is a typical setup of a minimal invasive surgery. They make a hole in your body, insert a light source and a camera, and inflate it with CO2. And then they insert tools into your, in this case, abdomen, and then operate under your skin. This is how it looks from the outside as far as port placement, and the physician is looking at the screen and operating on you. This is how the operating room looked like 100 years ago. So you can see that you only need two buckets and a table to perform a surgery. This is how it looked in the 80s. So the difference is a lot of technology migrated into the room, but not too much attention was paid to how humans are supposed to interact with all of this. This is not a storage room, by the way. In the 90s, a new element was introduced, and this is a surgical robot called the Da Vinci by Intuitive Surgical. One of the pioneers in surgical robotics once said that the most precious real estate in the world is the space above the patient, because it's limited. And once you start introducing more and more arms into this space, they start to hit each other, and that's a problem. So you can see that Intuitive didn't listen to this person, and you see how much cluttered this space is here. So just a brief overview about surgical robotics. It started in the early 80s, where people borrowed idea from traditional robotics, where you sort of scan or you know the environment that you deal with. You are working based on pre-scan anatomy, and you drill bones, and you insert probes into the brain. The next generation sort of left this concept alone and introduced the human in the loop. And most of the systems that were developed in the 80s, in the 90s, and still today, keep the human as the operator in a teleoperation mode. So the human usually interacts with the console, and it's a master and slave. So this is the master, and this is the slave. So, well, what is the big picture of surgical robotics? There is a vision that was put together by a professor of surgery, Rick Sutava. And his idea is that we can create an operating room where the only person in that room would be the patient. Everything else can be fully automated. So according to this vision, the person can go through an imaging device and get a full body scan. And then the surgeon can train on the critical steps of the operation in virtual reality, in a simulation. And then a robot is an extension of the surgeon's arm, and it would be teleoperated. You don't need nurses because you can have robots that would serve the surgeon. And the whole thing is managed by software that can keep track of elements that go in and out of the patient and make sure that nothing is left in. So I want to show you a video clip of a big DARPA project that sort of put this concept into a more visual way. So the military envision that most of the conflicts will take place in urban spaces. Once the soldier is hurt, you see these are vital signs. Every soldier would have a vest or sensor implanted in the uniform. This is sort of the operating room. This is the full body scan. It will be compared with an existing scan that each one of us would carry all the time. And then they identify the fact that something is wrong with the leg. This is a tool changer, so you don't need a nurse to hand out tools. And this is sort of an equipment dispenser where you take supplies and disposable for the surgery. The surgery itself, by the way, is teleoperated. So the interaction with the patient is teleoperated and not autonomously performed. And then you evacuate the patient. You can tell how remote you are from the field by how much you laugh, actually. And since you laugh, you can make that conclusion by yourself. So this is not funny anymore because I laughed too 2 years ago. But then I was part of this program for the past 2 years. And what you can see over here is 2 years of effort where an operating room was built, which is fully automated. You can see here, this is essentially the nurse picking tools from tool changer and equipment dispenser. This is the Da Vinci. This is where the surgeon is sitting. And this is the human interface that the surgeon is looking at throughout the surgery. To show you how it works, so what you'll see are two functions, a tool change and equipment dispense. And these are the vital sign of the patient, the overview of the operating room. Everything that is happening during the operation is backed up by a simulation that is running at the background. And this is the way the pods sort of know where each element is. This is a dispensing of sponges, so the surgical nurse would come and pick it up and deliver it to the surgical site. These two arms are teleoperated by a surgeon, so the surgeon would put them in a certain way or make a certain gesture, and then the surgical nurse would know that she can get in, or he. So you'll see how a tray was delivered, and then it will be placed temporarily on this close proximity arm. And then you'll see an automated way of replacing a tool. A lot of modification were done here. If you are in the field of autonomous operation, you know that it's very difficult to deal with a robot that from one side is very stiff and the Da Vinci is very flexible. So you'll see how flexible it is as the robot is pushing the tool back into the Da Vinci. And then the operation would sort of would continue. Now, this is sort of redundant, so we think we can skip. So phase two, that's supposed to start in 6 months, would develop a device like that. It's a robotic cell with imaging capabilities that can collapse on itself and can be delivered anywhere by any mean and can perform life-threatening, can treat life-threatening injuries. So I'll switch now to somehow different topic, but it sort of would lead us to why we developed the surgical robot, and I'll talk a little bit about this interface over here. So I'll show you two clips. One of them is an expert, and one of them is a novice, and I'll ask you to tell me who is the expert. Both of them are trying to suture in minimal invasive surgery, which is one of the most difficult tasks to do. So it should be clear by now who is the expert, and this one was over here, while this guy is still struggling. The reason why I show you that is that you'll appreciate how difficult it is to take an unstructured task like that and try to describe it mathematically. And the reason why we try to describe it mathematically is because we want to objectively assess surgical skills. The device that was used to collect most of the data is a passive device that is attached to regular endoscopic tools. And the passive device is essentially measuring all the position and orientation of the tool in space and all the forces that the surgeon would apply on the instrument. So you get a huge amount of data coming out of it. And so you can see all the forces, angles, and contact that the tool would do. By looking at that, you won't be able to tell me if this is an expert or a novice, right? So we can look at the data in a different way by just plotting, for example, the trajectory of the tip. So you see novice on the top and expert on the bottom. So you can start to get an idea of the difference. And this is these are the forces. But the leading idea to decompose the task is based on an interesting analogy between surgery and the human language. So what we believe is that surgery is like a language. And the most fundamental element in our spoken language, at least, is the word. And in surgery is the tool-tissue interaction. And if you use a Markov model that I'll talk about later, this is a state in that model. The same way that I'm pronouncing words differently and you can still understand me, is words are pronounced somehow differently by different surgeons depending on their skill level, and these are the forces and torques that they apply on the tissue. And these are the observation of different observation of the same state. And you can build on top of that and create a model of a step of the operation or multiple models that will describe the entire operation. So if you look at the tool has 5 degrees of freedom. You can move it in and out, left and right, up and down. You can rotate it and open and close the handle. So if you examine surgery more carefully, you see that surgeons are using these 5 degrees of freedom in different ways. They can use a single degree of freedom where they just grasp the tissue, spread the tissue. They can use 2 degrees of freedom of grasping and pulling, grasping and pushing. And they can use 3 degrees of freedom where they grasp, push, and sweep all at the same time. So each one of them has a certain signature of both forces and velocities that would identify or differentiate one from the other. So the next thing is to take this huge database and to reduce it. And the way we use it, we did it is we used vector quantization. And just to give you a conceptual idea of what it is, let's say that the data is like a cloud. We are looking for points in this cloud which have high concentration. So instead of representing every element of this cloud, we are just looking at the high concentration points. So we take the 26-dimensional data and we reduce it to a one-dimensional output. So this is a typical grasping, pushing, and sweeping state. And these are the different pronunciation of that state in terms of forces and velocities. So if you do it for all the states, this is essentially the language of surgery. You have 15 different states. You have different pronunciation of the same of the same word. And so you have the words and the different pronunciation. So how do you put all of this together? So this attempt was just to look at the single tool. And you see that experts and novices are using different states, and they are also using different transitions between states as they perform the same operation. So the way they navigate in this model is skill dependent. This is a general approach to represent two tools together. So you have states for one for the right tool and states for the left tool. Red lines are representing a transition between states of the same tool, and red lines are representing combination of a state in the left and a state in the right. So each one of them has a different pronunciation. So you see an example of a single state with the different pronunciations. So each line here is actually a probability. So there is they usually start with the idle state where they don't touch anything, and then there is a certain probability that they will move to a certain state, stay there for a while, and then move to a different state. So the way they navigate in this maze is skill dependent. And what we want to do is to extract the way experts are doing it and extract the way novices are doing it. And once we have a model for each skill level, we can measure the statistical distance between both of them. I won't go too deep into the math, but there are essentially three matrices that we need to define. A is telling you what is the transition between states of the same tool. So these are the black lines. B over here is once you're in a certain state, what is the probability that you'll apply a certain signature or a certain pronunciation of that word? And C is representing the combination of being in a certain state with the left and certain state with the right. So this is a graphical representation of a typical procedure. You can see, for example, that this was done by a left-handed surgeon. You see that the left tool is fixed, and the right tool is sort of changing probabilities. You can do it also in real time, so you can record all the data that I just mentioned and see how these maps would change as a function of time.
Question. I couldn't tell from this if the only thing that mattered is the position of the tools or the positions of the surgeon's hands, or you're taking into account the position of the thread, how many loops it's around as part of the state, or maybe if you're trying to cut a membrane, whether you're under the membrane or above it, is that part of the state?
Well, the assumption is that if you have a surgical procedure or a surgical step, they're supposed to do it right, meaning take two loops around one tool, put the thread through these two loops, and close. If the model won't tell you if you're doing it right or wrong conceptually. It would tell you if you are proficient in doing it or not. Meaning that I won't be able to tell you if they did two loops or one loop.
Okay, so it's not part of the state.
Right. Right.
So conceptually, that someone could actually just execute the motions very smoothly or going through the appropriate states, but not have actually even tied the knot, and the system wouldn't discriminate from it.
Right. So what you would hope is that the statistical distance obviously would get smaller as you progress to your residency, and we're dealing with surgical general surgeons who are going through 5-year residency, and you see how that's the hope, and the data actually showing that. So you see how a first-year resident is performing, and there is a huge variability in that group. And you see how the statistical distance is tapering down to an expert level. You can see that they are learning a lot in the first year and during the fourth year of the program. And this is completely an objective way to tell how far they are from being an expert. What they usually do is they record themselves, give it to an expert, and then an expert would look at, would grade their performance based on the scale, and experts are doing pretty good job in scaling skill. But this is a very expensive process because they can make $100 per minute in the operating room compared to sitting and watch video. So if we can come up with an objective and powerful way to do it, that's a huge advantage for them. An interesting thing is to compare between the two. So you take something that is completely subjective, and you take something, the Markov model, which is completely objective, and you get a reasonable correlation between the two, meaning that less than 86% is sort of explained by the model, and the rest is not. So I want to switch to a different chapter in this story, and I'll talk a little bit about the surgical robot itself. So the advantage of having data when you develop a robot is that you can take the data and you play it back through a mechanism or a candidate for your mechanism. In this case, what you can see here is a mechanism that we conceptually defined, and we played back the data that we record in real surgery, and we looked at how the mechanism would behave in this space. This is an early step where we develop a mock-up and put regular tools, and we wanted to check that there is no collision and the workspace is sort of well-defined. So the mechanisms that we decided to use for the surgical robot, it's called a spherical mechanism. And what is unique about this mechanism is that all the rotation axis would intersect at a single point, which is over here. If you put this point where the entry point to the body, what you essentially create a virtual pivot point, which is outside of the mechanism itself. And so the research question is, what should be the link length of each link here to guarantee a certain workspace? It's not a serial mechanism in a sense that links have lengths. In this case, the links are defined by an angle. So what are these two angles? This and that. So you go with the traditional way of defining a mechanism. You define the direct kinematics and the inverse kinematics. And an interesting thing that came out of the data is that 95% of the time, the surgeon are essentially moving their tools in a cone. And the angle of this cone is 60 degrees. The rest of the time, 5% of the time, they are moving in a bigger cone, and this would allow them to actually approach any organ in the abdomen. So you define your dexterous workspace such that the tool should move in this cone, and you define the extended dexterous workspace as a bigger cone. So the way we optimize the mechanism is we looked at the Jacobian. And the Jacobian is the mapping between the joint space, which is where the robot lives, and the end effector space, where the patient and we live. And just to give you an idea of what we're actually looking at, we define the isotropy as the ratio between the eigenvalue of the Jacobian. And what exactly does it mean? If you look at your arm as you write, you'll see that the arm is at about, the elbow is about 90 degrees. And the reason why it's 90 is because 90 for an arm which has the same link lengths would give you the best mapping between the shoulder and the elbow and the pen. It's very difficult to write like that, and it's very difficult to write like that. And these are the two singular configuration of the arm. So the isotropy is sort of a measure of how well you are manipulating your manipulator. So this would probably be 1, and this would be 0, and the same thing is when it fully flexed extend. The problem with this measure is that any point in your workspace would have a single value. And what we really want to do is we want to integrate over the entire workspace and see how the manipulator would operate over the entire 60-degree cone. So the optimization criteria is defined by three elements. The first one is you want to maximize the isotropy over the entire workspace. So this is taken care of by this equation. The second thing is you want to eliminate bad posture of singularity. You want to eliminate that, and you want to eliminate that. So you want to maximize the worst case in your 60-degree cone. So this is taken care of by this element. The last thing is you want your mechanism to be as small as possible, and small is stiff. So stiffness is related to the cube of the length. So your goal is to optimize this equation, and we particularly use a brute force, so we search over the entire spectrum of angles, and in each angle we make sure that the end effector would eventually end up in our dexterous workspace. And this is a typical result of what we get. So these are the two link lengths, and this is the result of the cost function. So you can see that at one point for these two values, we get a maximum. The problem with that is that if you set these two angles, the manipulator would be best in the 60-degree cone, but it won't reach the 90-degree cone. So you can do another optimization, in this case, define the 90-degree cone as your target. The price that you pay is that the manipulator would be much larger. So the solution was something in between. We took this solution and we eliminate all the cases that won't reach a 90-degree cone. And this is why you see this cliff over here. And eventually you get a single value that is sort of a compromise between the two. So following almost 3 years of very intensive design, this is what we got. This is probably the smallest manipulator that will give you the workspace that the surgeon actually need. And this is a description of the architecture. As I mentioned, it's a teleoperator, meaning that the surgeon is interacting with an input device. In this case, it's the Phantom Omni. They looked at a screen, and they watched the surgical site, which is over here. you can transmit this information back and forth to a regular internet or to a wireless, in this case a UAV, and I'll show you an example of that in a second. So the military is obviously interested in extreme environment, and this is an example of what they are looking at. They want the surgeon to sit in one place. This is a panoramic view of the site. So the surgeon is sitting in one tent. The signal is going through a UAV, which is you see over here. This is the pilot flying the UAV, and then it's bounced back to another tent. And in that case, you can bring the surgeon close, but not close, but not too close to put him or her in danger. Another experiment that we've done was a teleoperation across the Atlantic. And so the surgeon was sitting in Imperial College in London, and the robot was in Seattle. Another extreme environment is NASA has a human habitat in the Florida Keys where they put astronauts in simulated long mission under the sea. So the surgeon, surgical robot was, they put it in pots and they took it under the water, put it in this facility, and then the surgeon can operate, in this case, from Seattle to both wired and wireless communication to the robot. So this is a preliminary data that I can show you about the results. You can see that the limiting factors are time delays. And you see time delays in our wireless UAV experiment in the wired internet communication. And the limiting factor actually is the video and not the commands that you send back and forth, because it's very compact and small. I want to switch to something different, and this is the part that deals with exoskeleton. So just to give you an idea what it is, this is Lieutenant Rifley operating the exoskeleton. What you'll see is that she's using handles and buttons to move this machine. The question is whether we can set the human-machine interface at a different level. So in this case, it's being used as a human augmentation device where high forces can be applied through this this structure. So the idea is that you have a load, and you have the human in the loop carrying part of the load, and the rest is carried by the external structure. But the idea is that the control is being done by the human. The question is then where to put the human-machine interface. We don't want to use joysticks, and we don't want to use buttons. We want the interaction to be more intuitive. So one of the natural way to do it is tap into our neural system. Maybe we can take the signals, and these are the same signals that the brain is sending to our muscles, and interpret them in a certain way. So these signals can actually give commands to the actuators of the exoskeleton. And the idea is that you gain a lot by reducing the reaction time. And so we have a window of opportunity. And this window is we can pick the signal before the physiological muscle would contract. And there is a time delay between the two. And during this time delay, all the biochemistry is taking place, and all and the signal is spread along the muscle, and eventually the muscle would physically move. If we can take this signal and the position and velocity of the joint and run these inputs to a muscle model, and during this time delay predict what the physiological muscle would do, then as you move the exoskeleton, these things would move together. It's like walking with your dog that knows its way rather than dragging something that doesn't have any clue of what you want. So the myoprocessor is this element that predicts for us what the human muscle would do in a few milliseconds later. And what it does, it takes the EMG signal, the joint angle, and the limb kinematics and as inputs and eventually predict for you what is the torque, joint torque. I won't go through these individual elements. Each one has a certain function. One is dealing with the EMG itself. The other one is based on Hill model that is predicting that the force is a function of the length of the muscle and the velocity. So the physiological muscle is essentially a surface in this diagram. There are infinite number of surfaces, and the surfaces change as a function of the neural activity. So each point of this on this surface is an operational point for the muscle. So the force that the muscle would develop depends on the length of the muscle and on the velocity. So the Hill model is taking these two things into account. The last thing is muscles are not strings. They go through different paths. Sometimes they curve along bony structures and other muscles. So you have to take into account all the anatomy when you predict these things. This is a result of another design effort, and this is a 7 degrees of freedom mechanism that would support any degree of freedom that you have in your arm and support also 95% of the workspace. So you can essentially put this, put your hand in any point of the human workspace. And I want to show you some results of how it works. So this is a result of flexion and extending the elbow. So what you see on the top are the EMG signals of the biceps, which is essentially flexing the elbow. And on the bottom here is the EMG signals of the triceps, which is extending the elbow. And these are the process signals. And you can see that they are in a range of 0 to 1, where 1 is the maximal isometric contraction. So when you don't assist the operator, this is what you get. When you turn the exoskeleton on, you see how the neural activity is reduced significantly. And the reason why it's being reduced is it's being the exoskeleton assists you. So if you turn the system off, the loads that being applied on your arm and the joint torques that you need to develop are about the same. Otherwise, nothing would move. If you assist with the exoskeleton, you see that the external load is about the same, but this is the actual torques that the human apply, and obviously the distance between the two are what the exoskeleton would do for you. The question is whether it's a natural movement or not. And it's a very difficult question to answer. It's definitely a weird sensation as an operator to move something that sort of predict what you are about to do. So what I try to do here is I plotted the same information that you see here as a function of time. I plotted it one against the other. So this is the load, and this is the moment that you apply on the load. So if the exoskeleton won't assist you, it's about the same. If you're being assisted, then you get a gain, and the angle here is an indication of the mechanical gain. So then I took these results over here, multiplied them by a factor, an artificial factor. And I wanted to see how an ideal case, which is in this case it's the blue line, would look compared to an experimental case. And you can see that there is a pretty good match between them. So this is sort of telling you whether this movement is natural or not. Another interesting thing is what exactly you gain by going with neural signals. And this is a map that, the message of this map is how much gain you can get by different combinations of using neural signals and regular feedback. Regular feedback, I mean, there is a force sensor in the system, so if our muscle models are not predicting well, then the force sensor sort of helping out. So if you don't use neural signals at all, then you get a gain of about 8. If you use neural signals, you can almost double the gain. And double doesn't mean that it's not that appealing, but think about that. It's not doubling the torque, it's doubling the gain. So it means that if you're using EMG assisted, then you can feel 1/16 of the external load. What you can see here is white areas are unstable operation. So you can push the system by a certain amount, but at one point it will get unstable. Just to go back to the surgical robot, this is a picture that I took a few days before I reached here. And these are arms that eventually would slide along a surgical table. And the rationale is that surgical robots are like a hand and an arm. The arm is a gross manipulator trying to put the hand, which is a fine manipulator, where you want to manipulate. So what you see here are gross manipulators putting the surgical robot at the fine manipulation point. And the advantage of doing it is that you can emulate cases where the surgeon would move their arms to pick a tool and come back to the surgical site. So you see picking tool from different places and coming back. So the vision. We are being pushed to semi-autonomous operation, and it's definitely something that would eventually happen. There is no reason why a surgeon need to tie a knot. The surgeon can mark the beginning and the end of the suture, and the surgical robot can do it by itself. Teleoperation is another a challenge, and the challenge with teleoperation is time delay. So there is a time delay between the time you give a command for the surgical robot to move and the point in time where you see the result. The approach that that humans are doing is move and wait if you interact with a very time delay. But this is not an efficient way to do it. So using semi-autonomous operation, the surgeon can sort of design the sub step, and then the surgical robot in a remote place can do it by itself. Another area of interest is collaborating surgery. Traditionally, you see two surgeons are operating on surgical site. So you have four arms and four eyes looking at the site. Once surgical robotics was introduced, we sort of removed one surgeon from the site. We are left with one. Sometimes it's good to have more than one. The question is how they can control the same robot collaboratively, and what should be the priority if one is an expert and one is a novice, what should be the control rules to give one priority over the other. Another issue is image guided. There is a vision that surgical robotics and image modalities would coexist. They would talk with each other and work together, like exposing structures that the surgeon cannot see and guide the surgical robot to these places. So all of this is an effort of many individuals, and for you, a collaborative effort is given, but it's not happening that way in other places. So you can see there are different people coming from different disciplines, electrical, mechanical, bio, and medicine. And these are all the funding agencies that supported parts of this effort. And thank you for your attention. Questions?
So you showed us a very nice picture with EMG and mechanical gain and big white areas.
Right.
So that's a very narrow region in some sense. And given that EMG is a variable signal, you sweat or you fatigue, sort of the effective gain goes up and down, doesn't that mean that you really can't achieve that highest gain?
This was done in perfect conditions. It won't tell you the effects that you just described, which are absolutely something that we face. What the white area means is that the EMG sort of need to be correlated to the movement. At one point, if you assist too much, then the signals are getting very small. And then the signal to noise ratio is getting very bad. So when you're running into these conditions, these are represented by these white areas. And these are the sort of unstable operations. But this map, what you're really interested is in only a single operational point out of this entire map. This map is sort of exploring for you the entire space. But we are not discouraged by the fact that there are white areas here, because that's life. You only need one sweet spot, and you're done.
Your Markov model of surgical proficiency offers a way of kind of getting a snapshot of where someone is
right.
Proficiency,
right.
How they might compare on some spectrum of novice to expert. In surgical training, one of the things we're interested in is how we can actually move people more effectively from novice to expert.
Right.
Have you considered ways that that information might be provided in some tutorial feedback, augmented reality, or some way to help accelerate the acquisition of those skills and provide feedback to the student?
You're absolutely right. It's a snapshot. And if you're familiar with Markov models, there are actually two variations of it. One is a hidden Markov model, and the other one is a Markov model. So in a hidden Markov model, the states don't mean anything. In this model, the state would correlate with a specific motion. So if you look carefully at the model, you can actually tell them more than just how far you are from being an expert. And I'll give you some examples. There is the idle state where they don't touch anything. So what we discovered is that novices spend more time in the idle state, sort of trying to figure out what to do next. Well, experts would just use this as a transition state. So if you're looking for differences, we can tell you, well, you're spending too much time probably doing some cognitive analysis of the task, and you're not moving fast. The other thing is, for example, the application of force and torque on the tissue, which is task dependent. Our original hypothesis was that novices apply higher forces on the tissue compared to experts. But this was true only in tissue manipulation. In tissue dissection, it was the other way around, because experts knew how much force to apply to break the tissue in a controlled way, while novices were afraid to create irreversible damage, so they applied lower forces and applied over and over again, and this is sort of the efficiency of the process. So if you look not just at the end result, which is statistical distance between two, but if you look at the data that is accumulated in the model, you can tell what is wrong, whether they stay too much in an idle state or they apply the wrong magnitude of forces depending on the task. But another answer to your question, you can do it multiple times. Like you can do it more than one time a year and so and see how the surgeon would progress within a year.
I guess I was thinking along the lines of whether or not quantify performance to the extent that we could provide instruction by analogy, example, or modeling to a novice. That is not the Markov modeling, but something that would be, based on educational theory, appropriate to guide someone as to, well, here's how an expert would do this next step or this next series of steps, and show them that visually in real time, or provide them in sort of proximate feedback so that then they could get a sense of, oh, I've just seen demonstrated expert performance in a way I can comprehend, and I can move along the pathway more quickly.
Right. You're right. And if you look, if you, I don't know if you're a surgeon or not, but if you ask a surgeon, they would tell you that 70 to 80% is a decision making, and 30 to 20% is the skill. So it's the execution of your decision. This is not, it's sort of giving you hints where you have made the right decision, but it's not tracking the decision process that you've done. Another personal experience that I had with sort of trying to teach something how to move, and there was a simulator that sort of did the task. So it played back a task being done by an expert, and the idea is that you as a novice would hold the handles and sort of move the handles in the same way as an expert would do, which I personally think that it's completely useless, because if you don't know what the intention of the expert is, then just moving your hands is meaningless. But that's only personal perspective of things, so you shouldn't take that. Shouldn't take it more than that.
Cable drive?
Yeah.
Did you, how did that work? Was it stiff, or did it have some problems with stiffness? Was it a high-speed cable drive, like the room, or?
The motivation for going with a cable drive is that you can put, you see, for a 7 degrees of freedom mechanism, you have to have 7 actuators. And the idea of using a cable-driven mechanism is that you can put all the, not all, but some of the actuators on the base. And so as you move this arm, you don't move the actuators themselves. You can control stiffness by using different diameter and structure of the cable themselves, but it's not flexible. If you are trying to simulate a stiff wall in virtual reality, you hit the wall and you feel like it's completely stiff. Now, at the beginning, we thought that we could put all the actuators on the base, and we just realized that it would take too much pulley routing to go all the way to the end. So 4 out of the 7 are on the base, and 3 for wrist and forearm rotation are actually on the forearm. So it goes all the way to the elbow. That's the longest cable route. The surgical robot is again the same concept. You see all the actuators here on the base, and you route cables along the mechanism to reach every degree of freedom that you want. And This is actually, there are no actuators on the arm itself. And it's lightweight and therefore easier to get force feedback out of.
Any other questions? Okay, I'll start this video.